From the Sky News Centre at 5, world leaders and veterans have gathered in Normandy to commemorate the 70th anniversary of D-Day. Anna Jones reports.
Thousands of troops involved in the invasion were at today's events.
Among them are veterans of D-Day. And gentlemen, we are truly humbled by your presence here today.
President Obama spoke at a US war cemetery. While the Queen, Prince Charles and David Cameron gathered with British troops like Bob, whose thoughts were with their friends who died.
They are the people who are the heroes, not us.
The main event saw nearly 20 heads of state, including Russia's president, gather on one of the landing beaches. The French president addressed the crowds.
Merci.
Thank you. Thank you for having been there.
Before the events of D-Day were reenacted by performers.
Meanwhile, the Russian president and Ukraine's president-elect have met during the commemorations. Both Vladimir Putin and Petro Poroshenko called for an end to the bloodshed and violence on both sides in Ukraine. The father of a baby who died after contracting an infection from a suspected contaminated drip has told an inquest hearing he hopes his death will prevent other babies dying. Youssef Al-Kabush was just 9 days old when he passed away at St Thomas' Hospital in London. Soaring house prices are one of the greatest risks to the economy, according to the International Monetary Fund. The group's delivered its mostly positive annual report on the state of the UK's finances. Christine Lagarde is the IMF's chief executive.
Addressing imbalances in the housing market by alleviating supply-side constraints will require further measures to increase the availability of land for development, and to remove unnecessary constraints to land use.
That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is the new Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. A new campaign's launched against the British government and EU's support for fascists in Ukraine's new Kiev government. Yes, despite the newly elected president saying he doesn't want violence, Ukrainian army, air force and paramilitaries are mounting attacks in the east of the country where they've held referenda. Illegal ones, maybe, but saying that they want nothing to do with the new regime. They say it came to power in a NATO, US and EU-backed coup. Also, the 70th anniversary of D-Day is all over the media today, but was Operation Overlord, the Normandy landings, really the turning point in the war, as so many commentators are saying? Or did that come 2.5 years before, in early 1942, way over east in Stalingrad, when the Russians began to turn around the German advance? Anyway, we look 3 months ahead to September 1944 and Operation Market Garden, beginning to look at some of the events around it. As deals were done between Britain, the US and the Nazis for their precious technology, which included uranium and possibly plutonium too, for the Manhattan Project. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius, but dry. This weekend, highs of 20, showers and possible thunderstorms tomorrow. Sunny, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 21 degrees Celsius, sunshine and showers during the week. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of June, highs staying up around 20, sunshine and showers too. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is the new Green Councillor for Redland, that's Martin Fodor. Hi, Martin, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, good afternoon.
Martin, did I pronounce that right? F-O-D-O-R,
that's
Fodor.
Right. Fodor.
Okay. Tell us a bit about your background then. How have you come into politics? Where from?
Well, I've been interested in green issues and community issues, local economy issues for most of my life, frankly. But I hadn't got involved in Green Party politics until fairly recently. I used to work in the recycling sector, and I was involved in actually developing local recycling services before I moved to Bristol. was involved in a local charity, Children's Scrap Store, when I arrived here, and then the City Council for a good few years. And I dealt with a whole range of issues around supporting businesses, procurement, housing development planning, and a number of issues in the Sustainable City team, which is actually looking at the long-term future.
So were you actually working as an officer for the City Council?
I was an officer for Bristol until about 11 years ago.
Okay. How does one get into do that sort of job?
In my case, it was because I had practical experience of recycling, and the council had a new duty, which was to prepare a recycling plan. And if you look at our current pretty good recycling service in the city. We had none of that at the time. We were way behind other places, which had usually voluntary initiated schemes such as Friends of the Earth had set up in Bristol without council support. And it was my job to write the first recycling plan for the city, which many years later, I have to say, has now led to a pretty comprehensive service that saves us money every time the landfill tax gets dearer.
One of the things that people always get frustrated with is having loads of different bins to put things in, but hasn't that reduced a bit recently? I mean, the thing I have a problem with is where stuff doesn't get collected for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You've sometimes got large amounts of food waste basically just going rotten, haven't you?
Well, it's unfortunate if things go wrong with the service, and obviously one of the roles of the council is to be a sort of watchdog, a voice for the residents to make sure those complaints are heard and the service is sorted out. But it is very important to keep food waste out of landfill sites, because when it rots, it causes a very powerful greenhouse gas, methane, and it will be put to use by being collected and processed.
But what about the idea of having a service which some parts of the world do? I'm not sure if they do it elsewhere in Britain, where you just chuck everything into one box and then it gets sorted out somewhere else. Because that's a lot easier, and people find that a lot easier to do, don't they, rather than having to sort everything themselves.
Well, it's easier at the curbside, but what comes out at the other end is usually lower grade material that doesn't actually have the market value of the raw materials, the resources which we have, to be put back to use.
What's the Green Party's view on whether recycling of, say, glass is a good idea? Because, I mean, certainly I can remember as a youngster, everything just got reused, never mind recycled.
You're quite right, and I remember those days too. Generally speaking, reuse, repairing, putting things back to use, either as what they started at or as something more, something new or innovative, it is a much better solution. Well, I certainly wouldn't want people to think that recycling is an excuse for having a very wasteful lifestyle, and the amount of packaging we get.
But how do we change the system
problem,
so that actually what we're doing is we're building systems where, say, for example, if when you're buying milk or when you're getting milk, it comes as a bottle like it used to, and then that bottle then gets reused. Because there's a lot of energy, isn't there? I mean, you as a green person, yep. I'm sure, yep. very well aware of this, goes into either dealing with the waste when it's being recycled, mm-hmm. or else creating a brand new bottle or whatever it happens
yes.
to be. I mean, how do we create a global system, or at least a national system, which encourages businesses, in fact, forces businesses to do that?
Well, there's already an international trade in materials and resources that are for recycling. In other words, old paper and cardboard being made into new paper and cardboard, which saves clear felling of forests of some pretty dubious sources for the pulp and paper and other materials we rely on. So I certainly think we should have a circular economy, and that's very much a green policy.
But as someone that's worked in government, I mean, you've worked in, I think you said, the Department of Trade as well, isn't that right?
I did at one time, yes.
Yeah, I mean, surely this is something that the government's got to actually say, hey guys, you've got to do this, and if you don't, we're going to take it over.
Sure, that's one way to do it. In fact, there are ways that the incentives of ever increasing demand for resources around the world is actually making raw materials dearer. And also the ethical concerns about where some of the minerals and materials come from, like palm oil and the sort of minerals going into phones and so on, is making people think much more carefully about what they're getting. And it also boosts the recycling sector. But one thing I'd like to do that's very practical at a local level is encourage repair and reuse. We've got so many gadgets and bits and pieces, just about everyone in every street has something that could be put back to use with a simple repair, or could find someone else who needs it or who wants to repair it.
But how would you do that?
And that's something we could do locally.
How would you do that practically?
Well, there are a lot of vacant property in Bristol at the moment, and there are people with skills who could put them to use, and that could lead to real local businesses that are repairing and helping people.
The trouble is, you know, buying something new is quite cheap, isn't it? It's very difficult to actually.
Yes.
I mean, even, you know, back in the years of, I seem to be talking about the, you know, my childhood, the 1970s, a bit too much this evening. But in the old days, you know, you'd say if something went wrong with the TV, you'd take it in. Someone would
fix
the TV. The trouble is that a new TV to replace things nowadays seems to be a price that doesn't really demand or doesn't assist somebody to actually sit in a shop and spend their life repairing things. There's not enough money to be made repairing things anymore because the new thing is cheap.
Well, new things are cheap, and there are lots of reasons and subsidies that lead to that. But one quite positive thing that has come out of Europe, for instance, recently, and of course we now have our first Southwest Green MEP, Molly Scott-Cato, elected to the European Parliament at the same election that I was elected, and promoting the design and sort of repairability and the longer life of products is something that has come out of the European sort of directive on that. So we will eventually see products made that should be more repairable, should be longer life. But at the local level, I say there's still an economic opportunity, and I certainly think there are ways that the council can play its part in helping people to get start-up businesses in premises locally where everyone lives that could help.
But Martin, the council's cutting left, right and centre. Where are they going to find the money to do that?
An empty premises is a premises not paying rent. So putting it to use, starting up a business can lead to rent being paid. That's a very real thing.
Okay, so
that
if you've got a good idea, something to do, you want to use a bit of council property for free, where do you go? Who do you ask?
Well, I'd like to set something up. At the moment, I've not even got my council equipment supplied yet.
No laptop?
That happens next, not till next week.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean we have to stop. What I would like to think is that people can come forward and ask about vacant premises. The council has access to a single list of all the land and buildings, all the public property in the city now, and we should make some of that available for start-up businesses, without a doubt, whether they're repair and reuse or other things that are needed in the local economy.
Great idea, and that might even encourage some of the owners of all these empty offices in the city centre to get some of them into use too, and maybe even lower their rents.
You never know.
Who knows? Well, I mean, actually, maybe not, because what they do is if they lower the rents, then the accountants look at the books and they say, oh, it's not worth it anymore, and then they close the business down, you know, because your fixed asset on your balance sheet has gone down and the business isn't viable. So that's why they keep the rents up. But anyway, good luck with that. Sounds like a fantastic initiative. Tell us a bit about what you were doing as a civil servant. You said it was the Department of Trade, did you?
I was seconded, actually, to what was the government's social enterprise unit there, and that was thanks to my experience of the contract process and the procurement exercises that I'd been involved in Bristol City Council.
Okay, and when was that?
That was about 11 years ago, and I prepared the government document called the Public Procurement Toolkit for Social Enterprises. It was geared mainly at the not-for-private profit sector, but it was also of use to other small businesses to demystify how public contracts are let, how to be involved in the process of shaping the contracts, and then, of course, how to win those contracts, and most importantly, how to then be ready to deliver them successfully so that a social enterprise could win a contract, for instance, for recycling was one of the areas in social care that could be the case, and then deliver that contract effectively to provide the best service. Because businesses with a social as well as a financial purpose, or an environmental and social as well as financial purpose, can definitely provide a very dedicated service that delivers more for the users and customers. But the point is they need to be able to understand the process to win those contracts.
Well, that sounds like a good bit of work
It was very
Martin.
Popular. It ran out of all its copies within 3 weeks, which astounded us because we'd guessed how many copies, and we had to reprint a double print run within the third week.
I know it's an enormous document, but can you just give us a quick review of, you know, what some of the main points as to how these contracts can be won by small local businesses? Because, of course, the way it works nowadays, what you expect is for a contract to be run by somebody like CETA or an enormous, I think, is it Kia now that's running the
recycling? Our waste and recycling.
And these are massive multinationals that have got a whole army of people working on winning these contracts.
You're right. And actually, how we shape the contracts is important, which is why I said earlier, people should be involved in discussions about the shape of services. services don't have to be bundled together. That doesn't necessarily save money if there are other benefits that are lost from that. For instance, people with a better understanding of the needs of the service users on the ground might have no chance to bid for giant contracts that are let in giant bundles. So one thing I would certainly... I'm intending to look into is the shape of those contracts. And people should get involved. There are quite often meet the buyer events held. A lot of big projects hold what are called meet the buyer events, where they say, we're going to be buying, we're going to be contracting, we're going to need these goods, these services, these supplies. Who's interested in delivering them? And those things already take place. We've got to make sure they're more open, more accessible, and that there are also earlier discussions about the overall package of contracts that might be put out, and the council has choices ahead of it. Should it add more and more contracts into one big bundle, or should it break them down into sections that make sense for people? Catering contracts, cleaning contracts, all sorts of things that would mean that local suppliers or other independent suppliers can bid for them and win them, and also deliver them without having to know other completely unrelated skills.
No, because there's always questions, aren't there? People always ask, I do certainly, about the way that public money is spent and these That's sorts right. of contracts are awarded. How transparent is that whole process? Can you look and see how our public money is being spent here in the city?
You should be able to. It's quite bureaucratic, and letting any...
That sounds like you've got your fingers crossed there.
I'm not saying any of this is impossible, but I'm saying there are steps that have to be gone through, and people preparing to sort of consider offering to run contracts need to understand that process. That's what that toolkit was about, which is over 10 years ago. But there are a lot of issues the council should have regard to under what's called the Social Value Act. It's the social and other environmental and other benefits from its procurement work.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about this, and whether it really is possible for small local charities, not-for-profit organisations, local businesses winning council contracts?
It is, obviously, but it's you know, big organisations have got a big advantage in some respects with big contracts.
Sure.
And lawyers.
And the other thing, barristers. Of course, is that I used to be part of the social enterprise unit in the council here as well, after you, presumably. And there is a tendency, and it certainly happened under New Labour, for social enterprise to be a cover for essentially privatising services which ought to be in-house. And I don't, you know, I don't see this as a division between Labourites and green people. There's definitely social enterprise at one stage was being used as a Trojan horse to undermine, for example, things like home care in Bristol used to be run by the council, mm-hmm. and people were on decent wages, loyal workforce, been doing it for years. And of course, when you privatise it, you've then got people on cheaper people who haven't got the same level of commitment.
And what happens when that company goes bust as well? The council points their finger indeed. And says, well, that's it's not our fault, it's their fault.
That is a risk, and I totally agree. One of the things I said very clearly in the local election was that actually sort of major important public services should be run by and for the public, because they should be there for public benefit, not for private profit. And that is something I very much agree with. However, there are occasions where local specific things or different elements that are specialist can be run best by a dedicated unit with a social purpose or an environmental purpose. I don't see a sort of permanent tension between those two different things.
Now, also, this week saw the last rugby match on Bristol's Memorial Ground. Is that in your patch?
No, that's in the Bishopston ward.
Close to you, though. And so at the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. But not at the memorial ground, because the bulldozers are going in and we're selling it all off to Sainsbury's. What are your thoughts about what's happening there? Because Bristol's biggest memorial to the First World War, to I think it was given or bought by the Sheriff of Bristol and given for the fallen rugby players or fallen sportsmen of World War One a few years after World War One, and yet now the bulldozers are going in. There's not even a whiff of this really in the national news, but it is Bristol's biggest memorial to the First World War.
It's you're right.
They're not remembering. You know, this is what we're doing here, is we're just cocking a snook at those so-called the idea that the place was going to be there in perpetuity, as it was supposed to be.
Yeah, I was going to use the term in perpetuity, and that's very disappointing, because there was a resident who wanted to have the site listed by English Heritage, who chose not to. I'd like to say, firstly, of course, having excellent sports facilities in Bristol for Bristol teams and for all sports sectors, it is really important. That's something I support. And I have been to games at the Bristol Rovers ground, I have to add. That shouldn't be confused with the fact that the only business plan that seemed to come up was giving that site to a supermarket who were going to pay for another stadium. And I think that has muddied the water substantially to the point where giving permission for a supermarket, which was a completely separate planning decision, got tangled up with should there be a new improved sports stadium.
How is it going to affect your Redland ward? Because I think you've got quite a lot of shops there, haven't you?
Yeah, the longest independent high street in this country, if not beyond, Gloucester Road, includes part of my ward, the southern part of Gloucester Road, from the Arches, actually, part of Cheltenham Road, up to Crossroads at Barclay Road, Somerville Road. Local people will know where those are. And then beyond that is the other part of Gloucester Road that goes up through Bishopston, yeah, up towards the Memorial Ground. And there will be impacts on it, and the shopkeepers, a whole load of traders were extremely concerned, still are, I'm sure, about the arrival of a superstore, assuming that does happen, assuming Sainsbury's still want to try to get people to drive to a giant superstore.
Martin, when the BBC covered this Today programme this week, there was no mention of anything to do, even though they kept saying the Memorial Ground, no mention of World War I. The bulldozers are going into the biggest memorial to World War I in the city.
Well, I don't claim to know about the details of this, but it does seem to me very odd that something which is gifted to the people of Bristol, how can it be privatised in this way? I mean, you've got to Purdown up there. They've always wanted to build on that, but they've never been able to because it was gifted to the people of Bristol by whoever gifted it. And you know, and also coming back to what we were saying earlier, a lot of contracts are commercially confidential, certainly at central government level, and I find that absolutely impossible, ridiculous. These are, you know, government is entering into contracts, private finance initiatives and various other things, and we're not allowed to know what's going on because it's commercially confidential. Now, that's why you can't do it, because public money shouldn't be committed to contracts which the public have no knowledge of. And this has been going on for years under governments of every stripe, and it's actually, to my mind, completely reprehensible.
Well, at the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will not remember them, unless Sainsbury's at least put some kind of memorial to the lost people of the First World War once they've built their brand spanking new supermarket. Anyway, Martin Fodor, David Cameron is warning that Britain risks walking out of the EU if Jean-Claude Juncker takes up the top job. Now, this is the bizarre ritual of choosing the... in fact, it's quite nasty. It gets quite nasty. The European president, they kind of call him, when he's the president of the European Commission. And this year, this guy, Jean-Claude Juncker, is one of the top people from Luxembourg, which is, you know, obviously one of the big tax havens of Europe. So the idea is they're putting someone from Luxembourg, the tax haven, in charge. Anyway, what are your thoughts about Europe? You mentioned it a little bit earlier on. What's the Green Party's policy towards Europe these days?
Well, firstly, can I just give a story from my local election campaign?
Yeah.
Because in the campaign, we were extremely lucky, privileged, I think, to have the leading Green MEP chosen by all of European Green parties across the European Union, Scar Keller, who had been the youngest ever MEP elected to the European Parliament originally, and she came to Bristol by choice. She wanted to come to Bristol to hear about what we're doing in the city, dealing with refugees and asylum seekers and inner city businesses. And we spent a day with her here before she went to London to launch the Young Greens manifesto, and then back to many other countries as part of her campaign for the European parliamentary elections.
Was she flying everywhere? That's not very green.
I don't think so.
Okay, yeah. Good.
So, in fact, she chose to come here because the party groups, and she's part of what has been the fourth largest party group in the European Parliament, wanted to put forward their own candidates. And Scar Keller, the leading Green, was, or is the Greens' representative, for this top job, as you've
but
been
you've
about.
But you've got Molly Scott-Cato now. You were mentioning
she's
her.
An
tell
MP.
Us, tell,
yeah.
tell
yeah.
us a little bit about Molly, because I know you've got to know her quite well.
Yes, Molly's been here many times. I met her a number of times. She took part in lots of hustings, was very eloquent and extremely well-informed, and I think we're going to be really
what's
lucky
she, what's her expertise? What's she?
She's a professor of economics, specialising in radical and green economics.
I think we better get her in and have a chat with you, Martin.
She understands the money and the economy system better than any of the rest of us, I suspect.
Stops them pulling the wool over our eyes.
Oh, very, very much so. And she understands how the European Parliament can play its part in proposing and modifying and shaping legislation, which does affect us and which can benefit us. She also understands the funding opportunities that I think she will be able to approach to help this region.
So, European Parliament, should we be in or out?
Well, we want to see Europe made better. So we want there to be a choice of how it updates itself to deal with the sort of current situation. But it can be better. But I think overall the benefits are there from being part of the European Union.
Martin, what do you make of Jean-Claude Juncker? I noticed that also Christine Lagarde, as the boss of the IMF, has also been put forward as one of the possible candidates to become president of Europe. Well, this Tony Blair was trying to even tout himself, but I don't think anyone's taking
him
seriously.
This is turning into a rather vicious infight.
It is.
Juncker was there was a kind of agreement, as I understand it, that the biggest party in the European Parliament would get to nominate the commissioner. And it was the two major candidates were Schulze, who was the SPD guy, and Juncker, who represents the Christian Democrats, who are the biggest group in the European Parliament. But Cameron has immediately said Juncker's not acceptable because he's regarded as a federalist who wants to continue with the European project. So Merkel has been put in the spot. Because she's got to choose between what Cameron wants and what Juncker wants. And Juncker's actually got backing in the European Parliament. So there's a kind of battle now going on between the Parliament and the heads of government about where the direction of travel. Schulze and the Socialists and the Liberals are supporting Juncker because they think it's a way for the European Parliament to have more power. And there is, I've seen Michel Rocard, the French politician, was saying if Britain doesn't want to have Juncker, maybe they should just leave the EU. This is how serious this is all getting. And of course,
isn't this kind of sabre rattling in a way, try and get their way?
But the underlying all of this is the austerity policy being pursued by the EU and the European Central Bank, and Juncker is in fact committed to sticking with that austerity policy.
Now, Cameron is being accused of blackmailing Angela Merkel, which is not a good thing to happen on the anniversary of D-Day.
Well, they are not in the Christian Democrat grouping, because one of the first things Cameron did when he came to power was take the Tories out of the moderate right-wing grouping and get into bed with the far right in Poland and others, the Law and Justice Party. So, in actual fact, having walked away from the moderate right-wing grouping in Europe, they're not really in a position to tell them who they can and can't have to be the leader of it.
Now, funnily enough, I haven't seen one of those little slips come through the door asking me who I would like to vote for to be EU president.
No, the vote we got recently was for a member of the European Parliament.
Yeah, so we don't get a say in this. It doesn't sound very democratic.
For members of the European Parliament, so they then choose.
Surely it's the Council of Ministers that decides on this, basically Cameron and Merkel, and they will make a decision about it.
Well, that's what people in Germany are saying.
That's not democracy.
Cameron is basically trying to thwart the electorate's will in the European election, and that's not going down very well.
So what about this? Why don't we get a vote? Why don't we guests get to decide who is the president of the EU?
Well, we do have this indirect role, but I think the thought of... I mean, it was hard enough getting people to take an interest in the elections for MEPs, who are in theory local at least, and Molly Scott-Cato is from just up the road here, is one of our six MEPs in this region, to then vote for a presidential candidate who would be kind of presumably on show across Europe. There were debates for the four nominated candidates in Skidding.
But we don't get a say, so those debates really, they may as well have only taken place in front of Cameron and Merkel.
Well, they help shape public opinion, and I hope the politicians have regard to those. And in fact, some of the most positive feedback was on the performance Scar made as a European Green from one of the largest groups in the European Parliament.
OK, staying with the EU and the European Central Bank, Martin, there's Draghi, Mario Draghi. He's the president of the European Central Bank. He's not ruling out broader asset purchase programme. Now, for you and me, that means printing money or it means quantitative easing. Now, I thought that the EU, the European Central Bank, had decided that they weren't going to print money. But apparently, yes, European Central Bank President Mario Draghi did not rule out launching a quantitative easing asset buying programme if needed to boost the economy. He was asked at a news conference on Thursday this week why the European Central Bank had not decided on a more broad-based programme of asset purchases. Draghi said of plans outlined, "We think it's a significant package. Are we finished? The answer is no. We aren't finished here. If need be, within our mandate, we aren't finished here." Now, he's sort of talking kind of coded nonsense there, but what he's saying is, yes, we are actually up for this.
This is me you're asking. What they've done so far, when Draghi came to be head of the ECB, is he said, if necessary, we will do whatever is necessary to keep Europe from deflation. So he's just reduced interest rates to minus 0.5% in the European Central Bank. That means effectively that people, you've got to pay to keep your money in the bank, and that's because there's a real danger of deflation. And up to now, Draghi has been able to argue that by saying that we'll do whatever it takes, the market's stopped panicking. But of course now his bluff is going to be called. And the German Supreme Court decided that it was constitutional for them to print money if they wanted to, but the German government's still not very happy with the idea. And people are fighting for control of the airliner.
Call me naive, but I've never heard of negative interest rates before. So you invest your money in your savings account, and when you then go to take it out, does that mean that you've got £100 missing rather than £100 interest?
It's the ECB's interest rate, so it's right. the interest rate which they provide money to the rest of the system.
Well, that's going to be passed on to everyone else, surely.
Yes, but I mean, it gets passed on as a positive interest rate, so it's a way for banks basically to make, they get money for cheap money, and then they can lend it on for more.
Well, it doesn't sound cheap if you've got to pay back.
Well, that's the problem with it, is you then end a situation where people may just decide to liquidate. Negative interest rates it's not normal. We're not in Kansas anymore.
So what does this tell us about what's going on with the European economies? Because we're being told, aren't we, that things are rosy, that everything's turning round, and even the Queen was talking about the wonderful deficit being paid off, or at least we'll hear her a little bit later on talking about that. But what's indicated here?
Basically, the whole world economy is a slow-motion train crash, and the mainstream politicians are going to be... The smart ones know that it's a train crash. The stupid ones don't even realise. And when we get there, mainstream politics is going to be blown wide open, and UKIP is the least of the things we'll have to worry about.
Well, the other Martin Fodor, you're the Green councillor, new Green councillor for Redland. What's your view on all this economic stuff?
Yeah, well, I wish I knew as much as our MEP Molly Scott-Cato, because she really does understand these issues very thoroughly. But I think it's right. When a negative central bank interest rate means basically you get even less interest, just above zero, for any savings. I think the massive missed opportunity of the so-called austerity programme is that we could have invested the money that was basically handed to the banks and sat there and has then allowed them to help inflate house prices, could have been invested in vital public infrastructure and major projects such as making us energy efficient, developing renewable energy, putting in better rail services and so on, things that would have lasting benefit, create jobs, and actually provide us with the infrastructure that we really need to be fit for the future. And instead, it's sort of boosted house price inflation and consumption, which hasn't really done a lot of good.
Martin, the Guardian's got a great little Q&A on, will our negative interest rates, will it work, they ask. No one knows, they say. In theory, it sounds attractive, but it's never been attempted by the Eurozone and could have unpredictable and unintended consequences, including the possibility that banks will just pass on to customers all the costs they incur for depositing money with the European Central Bank. Sounds like we're being ripped off here once again by the banks.
The fundamental problem is the banking system is bankrupt, and it has been bankrupt for 5 years, and everybody's going through the motions of pretending that they're not bankrupt.
But also they're trying to get every depositor to pay for the bankrupt banking system.
Yeah. basically, and ultimately the whole population is being made to pay for the idiocy that went on in the casino we call the city.
And the banks haven't really changed their ways and still want bonuses.
The derivatives bubble is bigger today than it was in the crash.
One thing we've got out of the European Parliament is trying to put a stop to ridiculous bankers' bonuses, frankly.
Well, that's. I mean, obviously, I agree with that, but it's still rearranging the deck chairs on the time.
Oh yeah, the system's pretty broken. I agree.
What would you like? I mean, maybe I should be asking Molly this, but if you had the ear,
that would be a very good idea.
If you had the ear of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, what would you be saying to them?
Their money should be invested in useful infrastructure projects like energy efficiency and renewables across Europe are really vital for our future to get off the fossil fuel addiction that we've got and the ever-rising energy prices that we've got.
Okay, now I mentioned the Queen earlier on. Now let's have a little listen now to part of the Queen's speech and see if you can hear the poor old page boy keeling over at a very interesting policy announcement as he was standing next to a seated Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles.
For a successful transition in Afghanistan and will work towards a comprehensive nuclear agreement with Iran. The United Kingdom will lead efforts to prevent sexual violence in conflict worldwide. My government will work to promote reform in the European Union.
Well, that was not being too committed, promoting reform. But it was interesting, I thought, that it was just the moment when they're talking about the nuclear agreement with Iran that this poor page boy collapsed. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts on the Queen's speech more generally and the announcement for this? What is being said to be a parliament which is not going to have a lot of legislation? There's going to be quite a lot going on. But in a way, they're not used to having this kind of extra year before another general election.
No, I mean it's an election campaign that started now, isn't it? Really, and the next year is going to be like the Grand National. We've still got Beecher's Brook to go. Quite a lot of horses are going to die before the end of it. It's a politics is interesting. I mean, the other week we were talking about 60% of under 25s not planning to vote next year. And, you know, as a 54-year-old, I say, look, this is the most interesting, exciting, cutthroat battle that I've ever seen in my lifetime. And people say it's all boring and they're all the same. I think, goodness
gracious,
me.
Do you think there's a deliberate attempt to get people apathetic?
I think what's happened over the years is we've got a culture of, people, there's got too much distraction. So they've got loads and loads of things to think about. It's proper gender. So worry about this, worry about, and the real problems, like the banks are bust. We should all have been focusing like a razor on that for 5 years, but we haven't been. And because nobody knows what to do about that, so we then have various spats about things that are not that vital or central.
Okay, before we hear from the other Martin, let's hear the Daily Telegraph's 90-second condensed version of the Queen's speech, including, of course, right at the very beginning, a bit of heckling from Dennis Skinner.
Her Majesty the Queen commands this Honourable House attends Her Majesty immediately.
Coalition's last stand.
My government's legislative programme will continue to deliver on its long-term plan to build a stronger economy and a fairer society. To strengthen the economy and provide stability and security, my ministers will continue to reduce the country's deficit, helping to ensure that mortgage and interest rates remain low. My government will also continue to cut taxes in order to increase people's financial security. My government will introduce a bill to bolster investment in infrastructure and reform planning law to improve economic competitiveness. The bill will enhance the United Kingdom's energy independence and security by opening up access to shale and geothermal sites and maximising North Sea resources. My government will continue to implement major reforms to the electricity market and reduce the use of plastic carrier bags to help protect the environment. My lords and members of the House of Commons, I pray that the blessing of Almighty God may rest upon your councils.
Yes, well, let's hope it does. But the plastic carrier bags, maybe it's one of the most trivial things, but I'd like to start there, Martin. What are your thoughts about that? That's going to actually annoy quite a lot of people, isn't it? Suddenly, if you want a plastic carrier bag from the supermarket, you've got to pay for it.
Well, the interesting thing, I took part in a community initiative for some time in a few years ago in Gloucester Road to try and eliminate unnecessary plastic bags. And the great thing was, so many people were really positive and are now in the habit of taking a bag with them when they go shopping. It's not impossible. It can be done. And
what about the weight?
It cuts the cost for the retailers. You know?
What about the weightier issues, though, about fairness in society? I mean, that's a key issue in there. Are they actually going to deliver?
Well, I think this is a pretty bland Queen's speech for a sort of the last bit of the coalition, clearly. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of effort to do that.
Martin, cutting the deficit, we hear, but this is basically the government's. This is George Osborne speak, isn't it? They're not cutting the debt at all.
Well, she also said cutting taxes. That was very
yes,
clear.
That's right. Yeah.
Now that in fact is simply that's I mean, if you're going to cut taxes on low income people, maybe.
Sure.
But the Tories are actually clearing the way there for more handouts to their chums. So that's a fairly clear
signal. But isn't that what governments do? They do what their voters would like. And people who are voting Conservative have got a lot of savings.
Except that the electoral system is so dysfunctional that a minority of people decide who's going to be in power and then they get total power. And the coalition has, it's basically been captured by vested interests. And that's one of the real problems. We're struggling with this all over Europe, all over the world. And the real problem is that the politicians, in fact, are captive of interest beyond politics, and we've got to do a lot more to change that.
Okay, so cutting taxes, Martin, is that okay?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the interests of the cabinet, I suspect quite a few of them will benefit from things like that.
Oh, this is the millionaire's cabinet, isn't it? That's right.
Yeah, and for instance, we've got the most heavily subsidised unconventional gas or fracking sector in the world now, and yet they want to give it more opportunities to develop with the promise, which even the industry itself says is a pretty thin and unlikely promise, that it might bring down gas prices in the short term. And they're subsidising that to the hilt. And it's not really going to do anything other than keep us addicted to fossil fuels.
Well, if
for
you hear
a
sort
longer.
Of drilling sound underneath your house and cracks start to appear in the wall,
yep.
I'm afraid
you'll know.
There's nothing, you can,
no,
you'll nothing
yeah.
you can do about
That's
it.
There's
nothing you can do about it. This is the wonderful new revolution in energy. Martin, this is quite a big part of what the Queen was announcing there. She says, my government, doesn't she? My government. To what extent is it really government?
I mean, in a sense, this is a kind of constitutional anachronism. What ought to happen is that Cameron ought to give his own speech, and the Queen shouldn't be made to have to read it all out. That's what I mean. And, you know,
well, they do have a debate afterwards.
Change the electoral system.
They have a debate afterwards in the Commons on the Queen's speech, don't they?
The political.
Would you say
system,
abolish the House of Lords?
Well, they haven't got one in New Zealand. Why do we?
No, I know. Well, they seem to be the only people who are actually going through legislation and toning it down. Right. The more extreme.
The
things.
Point is, we need fundamental constitutional reform, including of the voting system. It's becoming increasingly dysfunctional. We no longer have a two-party system. We don't even have a three-party system. We've got a four- or a five-party system. Mm-hmm. And with first-past-the-post, it's turning the results of elections into a lottery. And there's a real problem that this is just not fit for purpose in the middle of the worst economic crisis for 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most sort of gratifying things just after the election was the number of people who came up to me and talked about how the fact it was the first time they'd voted for a candidate who'd won for so many years they'd almost given up voting. And it was because they could see this time that the Green Party was breaking through regionally for Europe and locally in my ward and other wards. And they were actually casting a vote for someone who they knew could get in. And we've got, well, as I say, the fourth biggest party, generally speaking, now, and yet largely ignored. And one MP at the moment. And we have added to our MEPs, of course, with Molly. But In places where there's a proportional system, we've basically got a much fairer representation.
Okay, another story. Russian Evgeny Bogachev is sought over the cybercrime botnet. Now, this guy, Evgeny Bogachev, is said to be known as Lucky12345. Doesn't sound like a very good password to me. And Slavic. He's accused of being involved in attacks on more than a million computers. He is, of course, Russian. The charges come as authorities seize control of a botnet used to steal personal and financial data. Now, this was the story going across the news last weekend, that we have 2 weeks, apparently, to fix our computers, to get rid of this botnet if it's on there. Otherwise, we may lose all of our data and our computers may be shut down remotely. Now, this is a pretty scary story from the UK's National Crime Agency, actually really just acting as messenger boys, in this case, for the FBI, apparently. They said people probably had 2 weeks for the criminals would get the botnet functioning again and posted advice on how to best protect computers. Well, I'm not sure how long they know how long it takes to get a botnet to function again, but it seems like a bit like guesswork to me. Internet service providers will be contacting customers known to have been affected by either letter or email. Oh, that better be first-class mail, hadn't it, if we were going to actually be able to do something in time. First notices were sent out on Monday, the BBC understands. Now, it's called Game Over Zeus. What are your thoughts about this, Martin Summers, first of all? This seems pretty scary. Is it real?
Well, I'm not a computer expert, I must admit, but I mean, at one stage in Bulgaria, they had more computer viruses being written per head than anywhere else in the world. And what you've got in Eastern Europe is you've got these very, very clever people, many of whom are now, you know, unemployed and with time on their hands, writing mischievous malware. And of course, what's being pushed in the West is this idea of a cyber attack on our systems. And that may precipitate the crash. In other words, that might be used as a means of covering a crash. Oh, the crash happened because the Iranians took the computers down, not because the banks are bust.
And also, you know, it may be even people on our own side that are involved in this. You know, is this really no way of telling whether this Russian guy is involved?
Did you see the Americans charge various Chinese military personnel with, they can't arrest them because they're in China, with, you know, threatening the US's system, you know, system of economics and computers. And the Chinese were just snorting because, of course, it's the Americans who are watching everybody through the NSA.
Martin Fodor.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, get a more up-to-date operating system, but it mentions Windows particularly.
All this is targeted at Windows,
but,
isn't it?
But, yeah, but I was going to say, I mean, the worst thing is the ever-increasing dependence on computers and the fact people are careless. They always will be careless. I mean, more and more of the public sector services are being switched online. That's not accessible to people who haven't even got computers now, and it's going to be pretty scary for people who are dependent on, you know, the least cost computer they can afford to run.
Look, call me cynical, but I would look at stories like this and I think, well, maybe the antivirus industry has got together with the people that sell these backup drives in order to sell a few of more of their products, because that's clearly what's in fact, talking about backups, this is something, just as a bit of advice for listeners, you know, just make sure stuff is backed up. If you've got if this botnet thing comes onto your computer and encrypts everything on your hard drive, you know, you're fine if you've got a little backup drive sitting on the shelf somewhere else in the house or whatever. It's all there.
That's
just do that every once in a while, and you're protected from these people, probably in an even better way. Another way of doing it, of course, is just getting away from Windows if you possibly can. Next story. A former Tory mayor of Weston-super-Mare and vice chair of North Somerset Council, Philip Judd, has admitted pornography charges. This is in the Western Daily Press. The former mayor of Weston-super-Mare and vice chair of North Somerset Council pleaded guilty to 12 child porn charges this week. Philip Judd admitted offences of making indecent photographs of a child and possessing prohibited images when he appeared at Bristol Crown Court. Court was told he possessed 151 films and 200 images of children. Judd was bailed and will be sentenced next month, when his name will be added to the sexual offenders register. The 59-year-old from Weston-super-Mare served as the town's mayor between 2010 and 2011, elected as North Somerset Council's vice chairman in May 2013. Now, actually, bizarrely, I was looking at this on the Western Daily Press website, and there's no mention of the fact that he was a Conservative councillor. But anyway, Martin Fodor, what are your thoughts about this? It's pretty shocking that someone in such an important position has got 151 offences. Films and 200 images of children.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's admitted this. He's guilty. I don't think the importance of someone is necessarily any guide to their sort of interest in something kind of as awful as child pornography.
Yes, because we like to think that people who are in these important positions, in a public trust, are in some way trustworthy. Martin?
I was going to say it's shocking. And I do know a friend of mine who actually had to review a criminal case possibly similar to this and saw some horrific material that they had to review in order to prosecute that. And I mean, anything we can do to protect children from this sort of exploitation and to stop people getting them.
I mean, how can our political parties be trusted to make sure that people like this don't get into these key positions? I mean,
well, the human nature being what it is, people misbehave in all parties, and it's not even a party political thing. But I will mention the King Cora Boys Home scandal, Ken Livingstone was first elected to Parliament. He made it his maiden speech about the Kincora Boys Home scandal in Northern Ireland, where it was basically a boys' home. It was being used by the MI5 to trap loyalist paramilitaries who would go in there, have sex with the boys, would all be videoed, and then they'd be told, right, nobody's going to find out about this if you start doing what we want you to do. And it's still a pending. MI5 were definitely doing that, and I'm afraid child pornography is used by intelligence agencies all over the world for blackmail purposes. And that is what explains an awful lot of what's going on here. But powerful people get drawn into these child abuse networks, and these child abuse networks are being run by intelligence agencies in order to control people's behaviour.
Somerset communities have been told to claim Hinkley C nuclear power station cash this week. Communities most affected by site preparation works for the Hinkley C nuclear power station are being encouraged to apply to a multi-million pound fund set up to help mitigate potential effects. Now, this fund was called last year by campaigners a social bribe. What are your thoughts about this, Martin Fodor? You're Green. Are you pro or anti-nuclear?
No, I've spoken out against nuclear power. It's unbelievably expensive and getting dearer. It won't deal with the so-called sort of lights going out issue because it takes too long and never gets built on time. And it has incredibly long-term costs that we're kind of going to face for
centuries. Are you talking about environmental or financial costs?
Financial and environmental. What's been done is to secure the French and Chinese government's interest in building this site. They've been promised 35 years of index-linked profit at twice the rate we currently generate power for. The wholesale price is going to be doubled to pay for this. And we'll be, basically, we're guaranteeing very, very healthy profits for the French and Chinese governments who are building and managing this. And the bribe being promised to the community, obviously, will be a sweetener. Funnily enough, only a fifth of the cost that's being demanded of renewable energy developments. So there's no level playing field for your nuclear power that gets dearer and has unresolved problems is being given lower costs and a higher subsidy than the renewable sector, which has got falling costs and is ever more sort of major contribution to our sort of energy sector, but is being asked to pay five times the subsidy for communities near developments. But we also know in the real world, most people actually like wind farms and renewable energy, but they're being put off them by this sort of a series of sort of claims that it's noisy and the ever-increasing costs, and they're scaring away the investors by the obstacles being put in their way.
Yeah, and I think the other point to make, of course, is that we're just not taking energy efficiency seriously enough. Talking all the time about where are we going to get the extra kilojoules from, what we need to do is design all of our kit so that it really... Why are cars not 100 miles to the gallon cars, all of them? They should have done that 30 years ago. Why didn't we?
Yeah, can I just add, actually, my last appearance in this studio on BCFM was discussing energy efficiency and workshops I run to demystify what people can do to their own homes to save energy and make their homes efficient, and things they can do whether they're tenants or landlords. And you're absolutely right. The government has wrecked the energy efficiency programme that was in place up till a couple of years ago, made it much more complicated, much more contentious. There are things coming forward that will help us, but they're too few, too far between.
Now, I seem to remember back in 2012, West Somerset Council went bankrupt. Bizarre, really, because it's an incredibly wealthy area. So it does seem maybe that this is playing a part in whether or not Hinckley is getting a cooperation of the council. They're saying, well, we've got big stash of cash over here, you poor little bankrupt council. And this sounds to me a little bit like a kind of, metaphorical blackmail going on. Martin?
Well, I mean, as J.K. Galbraith, the economist, said, you've got public, private profit and public squalor. So you quite frequently see this in the US, where the wealthiest areas have got their governments are the least well-financed, because basically people don't want to spend the cash to do the things that need to be done. And we've got to get away from this idea that taxes are a bad thing. Taxes are good. During the 1950s, when the top rate of tax was 90-odd%, both in the US and in Britain, the economy boomed, because you take it off the people who don't know what to do with it, and you give it to people who do know what to do with it. And of course, the people that have the money taken off them moan and groan. But at that time, of course, they were sold it, because we've got to defeat the communists in Korea and so on and so forth. But as soon as that pressure was taken off them, they then think, well, we're entitled to any amount of money we want. We're rigging all of these. The top pay now is hundreds of times more than shop floor pay. It used to be, a multiple. Now it's hundreds of times. It's just ridiculous.
Okay. Parents seek judicial review of term time holiday crackdown. Removal of head teachers' discretion to approve absences has prompted claims that education officials are breaching family life. This is in The Guardian. Parents who do not have permission for their child's absence from school face a potential 3-month jail term if they refuse to pay the fines. Now, this is really seems to be ramping up over the last couple of years. First of all, we're told, there's a fairly modest fine to pay if you take your children out of school in term time. Martin Fordor, what's your thought on this? I mean, obviously there are some opportunities that parents have to take their children on incredibly exciting and educational holidays during term time. Should they then say, well, we're not going to do that?
Yeah, that's a terrible dilemma, really, because very much we're the Green Party is in favour of very high quality local education, not putting people in debt to get themselves educated and so on, and we want good quality local schools for everyone.
But whose kids are they in the Green Party's mind? I mean, are they the state's children or are they their parents' children?
Well, I think we've all got a responsibility, frankly. I think the dilemma is that people are short of cash. Look at when the holidays are cheaper. So I was brought up in Scotland. Each major city in Scotland had a different holiday fortnight, as it was called, where people weren't at work in their sort of factories and workplaces. And actually that spread out the holiday going right well through a whole month or two of the summer, and actually made it much more sensible in terms of the costs of holidays.
But do you think there's a little whiff of we own your kids here?
It could be looked at that way.
Martin?
Well, I think when you say who owns the kids, is it the state or the parents? I say no, kids are individual human beings. Their rights matter.
Oh, yes.
Parents have some rights over children, but we intervene and take children off their parents if they can't look after them. And so we should. In fact,
so by taking them on holiday, does that mean the same?
Well, no, but I'm just making the point about the fundamental point about the children's rights as human beings, which are separate from those of their parents. I think this is the sort of thing that could be sensibly managed. I mean, what you were saying about how they run it in Scotland.
3 months in jail, is that sensible?
Ultimately, you've got to have, a parent may decide that they don't want their child to be educated, and then, of course, that has to be looked at. I used to work in an alternative school, and lots of homeschool people I know. But the fact is, you can't just let anybody do what they want with children without some eye being kept on it. And the idea that the parents have the ultimate right to do what they like with their children. I mean, of course, they've got some rights, but they're not the ultimate owners.
Just to also let you know, there's an organisation called Parents Want a Say that's campaigning on these issues. So that's all for now. We'll be back after the news. Thanks very much to our guest. You just heard there Martin Fodor for the Green Party, the new councillor for Redland. We'll be back after the news. Thanks. Talking Ukraine.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile.